Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Dr. Margaret Flowers, a pediatrician and mother of three teenagers from Baltimore. Margaret left medical practice in 2007 to advocate full-time for single-payer health care. She served as Congressional Fellow for Physicians for a National Health Program and is on the board of Healthcare Now. She has organized and participated in protests for healthcare, peace and economic justice, which have included arrests for nonviolent resistance. She is also an initial organizer of October 2011 Occupy Washington, D.C. Margaret Flowers is co-director of It's Our Economy.us, and she joins me now. Welcome, Margaret.
Good morning, Helen.
It's a great joy to have you on. Tell me, Margaret, a pediatrician, how did you get involved in the issue of health care and what you call in America single payer and what we call in Australia, you know, nationalized medicine? How did you get involved in it?
That really came out of my experiences in practice. When I did my training, I thought that I was being trained to go out and take care of my patients and help them to recover. And what I found instead is that in the United States, we spend a lot of our time arguing with insurance companies who have no interest in actually the health of their clients. And so we end up having to fight with them or find ways to write things in the chart so that the insurance company will pay for the illness, or how do we kind of finagle being able to keep the children in the hospital as long as we think they need to stay in. That was just very frustrating to me as a pediatrician. Children are so important, and what I found was that the length of stay that the insurance companies would give or the treatments they would pay for were not in the best interest of children.
Yes, I had a similar experience when I worked at Harvard, actually in the 70s in the cystic fibrosis clinic, and I found that parents couldn't afford antibiotics for their dying children. I mean, I'd come from a system in Australia where healthcare is free, and I just really couldn't believe what was happening. It was beyond belief. And then I remember, actually, at about the same time, the president of the American Medical Association said medicine is a privilege and not a right, and I couldn't believe that either.
Right. And if you can imagine, things have only gotten worse since then, with, you know, more people that are uninsured, people that go bankrupt in this country because somebody in their family has an accident or gets ill, and people here have to take on extra jobs if a family member is sick, or they have to have fundraisers with their neighbors to pay for medication. It makes no sense, knowing that our country spends the most per capita per year on health care. We pay more than enough already nationally to provide a universal, lifelong, comprehensive health care, you know, to our population.
Yes, and the overheads for the insurance companies are huge compared to the overheads, for instance, for Medicare, where people get free health care once they pass, what, 65 or something?
Correct. If you're 65 or if you have a disability, you can have Medicare, which is a type of single-payer system that's paid for through taxes that are collected. And then it, you know, creates a nationwide health system. And so often the way we explain what we're trying to accomplish here is, you know, at the least to have like an improved Medicare for all, although ideally if we had something that was more like an actual national health system, that would be the most efficient, most likely.
It would. And the other thing that really grates on me, Margaret, is that you've got a socialized killing system and a private capitalistic healthcare system, and when I say killing system, it's the Pentagon, where over $1 trillion dollars altogether is spent on killing, or weapons to kill, or plans to kill, or whatever.
Right.
And here are we struggling to save our patients and help people. And why do you think it's developed in this way? What's the history of this really quite obscene system, Margaret Flowers?
Well, it goes back a long way and really speaks to kind of what our nation has become. As far as our war spending, 65% of our federal discretionary spending is on either defense, so they call it defense, we don't really think of it as defense, and our homeland security and intelligence here in this country. And that's never on the table when they talk about needing to make cuts. That's always excused. It's the other 35% that goes for employment support or education or healthcare that's up to be cut. But what we really have in this country is a political system that's run by the corporations. The big corporations are the ones that fund the campaigns of our elected officials, and they're the ones that write the legislation.
They
and
are.
So really, we've become, as you're probably well aware, the United States is the biggest empire in the history of the world, and it's just it's causing so many problems here at home.
I know, but I don't understand, Margaret, if you can take us back to how did this whole system of, quotes, medical care develop? I mean, why do the poor old employers have to even pay health insurance for their employees? Why? I don't understand how it was derived and developed.
Well, the link between health insurance and employment was really kind of a fluke of nature. It happened back in World War II, when the wages were held at a constant level here in the United States. And so employers started offering benefits like health insurance to attract employees. But that was never meant to be the basis of a system, and it's not working. In fact, we're seeing a steady decline in the number of employers that can afford to provide health insurance for their employees. But the privatization of healthcare in this country really took a leap in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president. And he actually, during his administration, our public dollars were used to bring Wall Street companies into Washington, D.C. to the Department of Health and Human Services and train them in how to take over healthcare as a profit-making venture. And that's when we really see the data change, where we see our healthcare costs starting to rise more rapidly, and also the number of people that are uninsured also rose, and our health outcomes started to decline.
So it was the lovely Ronald Reagan, who incidentally I met and spent, oh, you'll be interested in this, Margaret. I'll tell you a little snippet of a story, but I had to speak with Paul Newman before a group of film stars in the Playboy Mansion run by Hugh Hefner. And at the end of my talk, this tall girl came up and said, I think you're the only person on earth that can change my father's mind about nuclear weapons. And, of course, she was Patty Davis, Reagan's daughter. And to cut a long story short, we did get in to see him, just Patty and I. I spent more time alone with him than any other person during his 8 years of presidency. And I ended up, because I just finished my book, Missile Envy, I knew, so many facts and figures. And everything he said was inaccurate and incorrect. The technology, numbers, you name it. And so I ended up half the time holding his hand to reassure him, because, when he got anxious, he'd get a malar flush. For those who don't know what that is, I think you get that mitral incompetence. You get a flushing of the cheeks, and his cheeks would flush when he was anxious. So I would hold his hand to reassure him. So in truth, we developed a doctor-patient relationship where I could actually assess his IQ, and clinically I assessed it to be about 100. Well, and I also came out of the meeting saying I thought he had impending Alzheimer's, which he did. But that's just a sort of little anecdotal story. But it's interesting how he was such a clever actor that he was able to induce lots of people to love him, the sort of, oh, shucks, sort of attitude. But it was he who destroyed the unions to a degree. with the air controllers strike and sacking all of them. But also, I didn't know that he introduced insurance companies and private companies into the Health and Human Services. How did he do that, Margaret Flowers?
Well, they brought in investment groups like Solomon Smith Barney and trained them in administering healthcare. And so they started private insurance companies. They started private hospital corporations that have been buying up hospitals and just using them as ways to make profit. I hear so many stories as I travel around the United States speaking to patients and to health practitioners, and it's unbelievable that there are actually people in this country who work for hospitals, and when they themselves, and who are insured through their employer, but when they themselves have a serious illness, are denied necessary care.
Really?
Really. There was one that's very striking was a man who worked in a development office, and his job was fundraising for different technology that the hospital wanted to acquire. And he was responsible for bringing in a new radiation machine. Then he got throat cancer and required that radiation to treat his cancer, and they denied him.
Who's they?
The insurance company that the hospital had chosen denied him the treatment from a machine that he had gotten for the hospital.
It absolutely takes your breath away, doesn't it? I know for myself, just anecdotal too, and you can give us some of your anecdotal stories, but you've got a patient, you're in the emergency room, and you need to treat the patient with certain drugs or whatever procedures, and you ring up a little girl in the insurance office who looks up the computer and works out whether or not you can do that because it's either legitimate and they'll pay for it or they won't. And so you end up arguing with someone who has no knowledge of medicine at all, right, like in the middle of the night trying to save your patient. Have you got similar stories, Margaret?
Right, absolutely. And if if you're demanding enough and you can finally get through to a physician who serves as a medical director, sometimes you can convince them, but they act like you've really put them out and they're doing you this huge favor. And that's so frustrating. I mean, I did very well in medical school. I trained at a top-notch institution, and my judgment was being undermined by people who had no medical knowledge.
Oh, I know. It's terrible. And also, if it's the middle of the night, they're unlikely to get up, those doctors, and answer your call. The whole thing actually is rotten. Something is rotten in the state of Denmark. Something is rotten in the state of the US. And I do know that many, I think half of the people going bankrupt, it's because of medical bills that they can't pay. And I don't know even, Margaret, how old people, I suppose Medicare covers it, how they cover the cost of all their drugs they have to take.
It's actually, in terms of bankruptcies, it's now 62% of personal bankruptcies are due to medical costs. And the striking feature for me is that almost 80% of those people who went bankrupt had some form of health insurance. But in this country, health insurance is not synonymous with actually being adequately covered, because so many people have plans that have high deductibles, and the insurance only covers what's considered to be covered benefits. So many insurance companies will find ways to kind of finagle it and say, well, oh, that's something that's experimental, or that's something that we don't cover. And then people are left, paying for that completely on their own. It's really cruel, to be honest, what's happening in this country. Because people so often here complain that if we had a health system, we would ration care.
That's absolute rubbish.
Right, and if we ration care already, but we do it in the cruelest way, based on someone's ability to pay. And really, we believe that the cost of health care at the individual level should not be tied to the severity of illness, because we know that by creating a single public fund to pay for our health care, we can take care of our needs.
I'll say so. Okay, so what answers are you coming up with, Margaret Flowers?
Well, I've been advocating for a number of years now for some sort of a single-payer system. And I had started out working at the state level trying to push my state, which is supposed to be a fairly progressive state.
What, Maryland? Is it Maryland?
Maryland,
yes.
Right, to take a, look at this approach. And in 2009 and 2010, when we knew that healthcare was on the national agenda, I served as the congressional fellow for the organization Physicians for National Health Program, and naively thought that we were going to actually have a debate in this nation about how we could solve our healthcare crisis, and found that was where I really had my eyes opened, that it really is the industries that write the legislation, that influence the legislators, that are the ones that are allowed to testify. And so we did as much as we could during that time to try to at least make people aware and try to push the reform to be based on evidence of what's best and would meet our needs. But that didn't happen. And that's actually why my next step was to move into working on an occupation, the Occupy movement, because if we're going to take on the corporate powers that are controlling our political process and also in many ways control the media message in this country, it's going to have to be an effort of all of the people and organizations that work for social and economic justice. We've got to see healthcare as part of the broader struggle for social and economic justice. And you're probably aware of the high degree of wealth inequality in the United States. And that even if we do provide access to health care for everyone, our health outcomes are likely to continue to be poor because so many people are lacking in education or are losing their home or don't make a living wage or live in a violent environment or an environment that's polluted. And these are the things that we need to address if we really want to have a healthy people.
You're absolutely right. You know, I had such hope when Obama ran the first time as president, and he seems to be captured by the powers that be, has become a capitalist president. Do you want to comment on that, Dr. Margaret Flowers?
Well, yes. I was hoping when President Obama was elected that this would be an opportunity for a real debate, because in the state that he came from, in Illinois, as a state senator, he was supportive of their state single-payer health bill, and he was also a neighbor and friend of one of the doctors who founded Physicians for National Health Program, Dr. Quentin Young.
Oh,
and
I know Quentin Young. Is he still alive?
Yes, isn't he wonderful?
Oh, he's wonderful,
he's
yes.
He's doing very well.
Yes.
And he and then State Senator Obama actually were on a campaign in the state of Illinois as campaigning on health care as a human right. But President Obama, took $20 million from the health industry during his candidacy, his election, and that seems to have had an influence on him. He was he and the White House really struck deals with big pharmaceutical corporations, health corporations, and the health insurance companies before they even started the process of health reform, and it just shows that in the United States, it doesn't matter right now who we elect into this system. The system itself just doesn't work,
yeah.
And that's why we're trying to create a movement that's an independent movement and that really uses nonviolent tactics to try to shift the power in this country.
Well, I think that the Occupy movement, I did speak twice at Zuccotti Park when it first started. Once was on the risk of hair trigger nuclear annihilation, and I also said that your Congress people are not your leaders, you are their leaders and they are your representatives, and I said the president is not your leader either, he's your representative, and that you must occupy Congress. And then the second time I spoke, I talked about a meltdown at Indian Point nuclear reactors, which are 35 miles from Manhattan. It was funny, one bloke yelled out from the audience, "You're making me depressed." And I said, "Yeah, well, you need to know the truth.
Aware.
I'm a doctor and we always tell the truth to our patients." But I knew that the thing would die down during the very cold winter months. No one could stay outside like they did. And then what's worried me, Margaret, is what happened in Oakland with these awful black ops people who came in to the movement and started chucking rocks through windows and being violent. And of course, they're obviously infiltrators. And these movements are always so open to infiltrators who can wreck the whole darn thing, right?
That's absolutely correct. And I actually just finished a tour of the West Coast where I visited occupations from Arizona up through California, Oregon, and into Washington State, where they held a solidarity social forum of the occupations. And there's a lot of discussion right now and concern about these behaviors. It's happened in a number of places of, you know, escalating into being aggressive with the police and breaking windows. And so we were really talking as we traveled about the importance of knowing what it is that we're working for and what our overall strategy is, and then making sure that the tactics we use serve that strategy. And right now we're a very young movement. We're trying to grow the movement. And these types of actions, these senseless actions, actually harm the movement by turning the police against us, justifying their aggression, and turning the public opinion against us as well. But there are also the question of infiltrators is a very important one, because we're seeing similar patterns throughout the country of behavior that really indicate that there are infiltrators pretty deeply into the movement. They attack people personally who take on any type of a leadership role. We see a lot of focus on finances, questioning finances, and then also around various occupations, there are people who get control of the website or the social media or the email lists and then abuse those.
Well, Chris Hedges, who used to write for the New York Times and is now, I think, at The Nation, has just written an excellent article about that, and it's really quite staggering, Margaret, the amount of money that now Homeland Security and the FBI and the CIA have to place infiltrators in organizations which are totally trying to change the social structure of America. And I tell you, it actually happened, I'm sure, at my organization, Physicians for Social Responsibility, which I actually created. And I was forced out by a coup d'etat, but I'm sure it was orchestrated. And what I learned from that, and I think it might help you, is that anyone who comes into the movement or your board and creates dissent, I mean, we're a wonderful group of, I think, 18 on the board, and we used to argue like mad, but in a very constructive way, and exciting, it was so exciting, because we were leading a revolution to abolish nuclear weapons. And then I invited someone on the board who shall remain nameless, but dissent began. And what I learned from that is you have to keep your radar going at 360 degrees all the time. And if anyone comes in that creates dissent, they're out. I mean, you don't ask them, you don't be polite. You just use your intuition and they're out. Because if they're in, they'll take up so much of your energy trying to work against them or keep others together or whatever, and you're up against a big, big problem, Margaret.
Yes, and that's absolutely what happened at the occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C.
Really?
My partner, Kevin, and I were in a small group that initially started organizing that occupation, and it grew, and we actually had an excellent group. We had about 45 of us that were working pretty closely together, and then another 55 or so people around the country that were working at the state level as state coordinators. And we had a few people that tried to disrupt that organizing, and we did have to ask them to leave, but we were naive to think that the same thing wasn't going to happen in Freedom Plaza. And it was a very well orchestrated effort that that worked very well to create division, disruption, telling lies, and we finally had to separate from that. And we're very focused on the next effort, which is the to bring the occupations together in the spring in Washington, D.C. for something called the National Occupation of Washington, D.C. And we've really changed our organizing practices as a result of that experience.
What you have to do is keep this group of people you're working with constructively very small, so you really, really know them. And don't let anyone else in. Don't let anyone else in. Those you trust and creative, keep with them. And others can be peripheral, but don't let them near the records or the bank accounts or anything like that. If you do that, I mean, I don't like boards, period. I have a board with three people on it, people I know and trust. I think that's number one. And number two, you know, we do know that we are up against the most powerful forces the world's ever seen, including the Pentagon.
Right.
Including the Pentagon. And so this ain't small bickies. This is big bickies, as we'd say in Australia. Bickies meaning biscuits. You know, am I going to be there on the 30th, Margaret, in spring?
Yes, I hope so. We haven't determined exactly where. We'll be doing that on the 30th, so I'll let you know, but we look forward to having you.
The American Spring, huh?
American Spring.
Oh, it's so exciting. I know that when I went to Zuccotti Park, it was just the energy there was quite extraordinary with all sectors of society present. And I felt more excited, more optimistic than I think I've felt for 20 years, Margaret.
That's how it felt at the beginning in Freedom Plaza. We had several thousand people there the first weekend, and people were either just laughing and smiling, or they were crying because they were so happy because so many people came together. The messages that the signs that people had were just amazing, and it was really a transformative experience. There were a number of people that had never been involved in activism before who were very transformed by those experiences.
Yes. I interviewed Michael Pollack the other day, who is the attorney working with Occupy, and he told me about your legislative demands and reforms, and it's not just more Occupy people coming together, although that's very important. And I know that you have the support, I think, of about 63% of Americans in what you're doing, but you've got to be absolutely brilliant, Margaret. you've got to be more, and I'm sure you are brilliant, having, you know, gone to a wonderful medical school and you're a brilliant doctor. But by God, this is like treating a dying patient, and the dying patient is the American democracy, and it's also the planet.
Absolutely. That's why I agree with you that both. I feel it's very important to tell the truth, and I don't want to engage in an ineffective treatment. So we have been really pushing for this, creating an independent movement that's broad-based and nonviolent. And we're actually encouraging people to put their energy right now into building the movement, to educating each other, and to developing alternative systems outside of the corporate system to start meeting our human needs. So creating public banks and local currencies, collectives for living arrangements, cooperative businesses, these types of things that we can do to start meeting our needs now.
Boy, it's big, though. I mean, when you look at the powers that be that you're up against, my God, it will have to become ubiquitous. It's like people say, well, they're going to withhold their taxes so, you know, the Pentagon doesn't get funded. But unless everybody does, it has absolutely no impact. So the question is, how do you get enough people involved to have an impact? Now, you have had an impact in that no one wrote about the 1% and the 99%. I mean, it was all just sort of taken as a matter of course in, you know, the reporters in the New York Times and the Washington Post and people on television. And since the Occupy movement began, everybody's talking about it. The columnists are writing about it. The opinion pages are full of it. So you have changed the way that people look at things and the philosophy. But to be pragmatic, as we are as physicians, it's no use sort of curing the pimple on the nose of a patient dying of cancer.
Right. And And we've had an even more of an effect than just on the public debate and the discussion in the media. We've actually feel like we've had some effect on policy. There was a committee that was put together by the president. It was called the Super Committee, 12 legislators who were in charge of making recommendations for the federal budget. And they were absolutely heading down the road to be cutting our Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and the president was supporting that. And we did a number of actions in Congress around that super committee, protesting outside in the hallway, outside of the building, also inside the committee. One of our people who's now president of Veterans for Peace, a woman named Leah Bolger, actually went right up to the members of the super committee in their hearing and told them to their face that they were fraudulent and they were not representing the 99%. And people walked all the way from New York to Washington, D.C., specifically to protest that super committee. And when it came time for them to make their report, they made no recommendation. That was pretty amazing. And then just recently, there was an agreement with the banks around foreclosures of homes, and the president was pushing to give immunity to the banks so that they couldn't be prosecuted by people who lost their homes, and that immunity was dropped in the final agreement.
How did you do that? Did you occupy the committees again or what?
No, this time I think it was because there's been a huge campaign around the country, various occupations working on something called Occupy the Homes, where they've been helping people that are losing their homes or going to be evicted and actually preventing them from being kicked out of their homes and also disrupting auctions of these foreclosed homes to prevent them from being auctioned off.
Oh, that's wonderful.
A lot of energy around that.
So I love the idea of you going into Congress and into the congressional hearings because, of course, they can't stop you because, you know, it's your Congress, you own it. And then I love the idea of doing a mic check there in the middle of the hearings. Did anyone do that?
We did. We did a mic check outside of the inside the Senate building. One of my favorite mic checks that we did actually was inside the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, where there was a CEO of an insurance corporation giving a talk at a luncheon, and we did a mic check there, and there were a number of people inside, so that as one person got dragged away by security, the next person was able to pick it up, and they got through the whole thing. And C-SPAN, which is one of our television stations here, covered the whole mic check. The camera actually followed each of the people that was speaking. They did a great job for us of videotaping it.
Oh, that's wonderful. So, yeah, that's a creative thing that needs to happen. I mean, occupying the houses that are going to be taken over by the banks, that's very powerful. Occupying Congress and the congressional hearings. In fact, I think that could be one of your major planks. I mean, you come in wearing your pearls, your high-heeled shoes and your stockings. So you look or pinstripe suits. You look very classy and you go like any lobbyist. And then you go into the congressional hearings, which you're allowed to do. And then at a certain point in a prearranged time, you do a mic check.
Right. That's, that's something that we actually did back in 2009, in May of 2009, when the very first committee took up the health legislation. It was a Senate Finance Committee. And that white paper that they put together is actually the one that the whole bill was revolved around. And they would not allow any people who were experts on health policy, on single payer, to testify before the committee. It was all industry representatives and big business. And eight of us went down there. It was three physicians, two lawyers, and three health advocates. And we dressed properly, and we were ready to testify. And we stood up one by one as the committee began and asked if we could testify. And we were each arrested for doing that. But
arrested.
It did have an effect. Yeah, yeah. That's what happens if you speak out in our Congress. Actually, and the woman who took on the super committee was arrested as well. You're not allowed to speak in these public hearings.
A public hearing and you get arrested, that takes my breath away.
Yeah, but it exposed what was going on. And the next committee, which was a Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, which actually was chaired by Senator Ted Kennedy at that time, he was still alive, contacted me after that, and I was the first person to testify before their committee. So it did it had an effect. We were able to testify then also on the House side in the three committees there. Unfortunately, it had no effect on the final legislation, but at least I was able to stand before the Senate committee and tell them that, you know, market-based healthcare is a failure.
And Dr. Margaret Flowers, when you did testify, did you talk? I find the most powerful, potent thing to do is to recount the story of one of your patients and what happened to them. Did you use that, in fact?
You know, I did not. I had such a short time to speak, and that was my first time testifying in the Congress. I really focused much more on kind of the big picture and how the market has failed and what the result of our market-based health system has done to people. But certainly after that, we put out the call for the summer and asked health professionals to come to Washington, D.C. and lobby. And it was almost like doing medical rounds. We would set up days where we had numerous appointments and we would just go from office to office and educate the health policy staffers on health policy. Many of them didn't even have a background in health policy and they didn't even know the basics. And that's where we would talk to them about both the policy and tell our personal stories.
Do you know what you should do, actually? And I think because this is the age of television, you should wear your white coats when you do that and your stethoscopes.
We did,
and
yeah.
Those. Oh, you did?
Yes.
Oh, good. Yeah, because that makes for good TV.
Yeah, I've been arrested a number of times in my white coat now, and it does make a dramatic appearance.
You know, and I always think you should wear those mirrors. Remember that we used to wear to look down people's throats, the things
on
our heads. They're kind of rather classy too. You look like a doctor in them. The other thing that gets me, Margaret, is what is the attitude of the majority of the medical profession in America towards this rather obscene situation of so-called healthcare?
Well, it's very interesting, you know, psychologically, because as I've traveled around speaking to doctors, one physician actually put it very well, and he said that he believes that most physicians in America are in a stage of grief. Some of them are in denial, some are angry, some are bargaining, some are accepting the situation. We get into this situation, and it's how I was at first when I was in practice, where you just want to take care of your patients. Mm-hmm. And so the more forms they give you, the more hoops, you know, phone calls you have to make, you just focus on trying to get that done to get the care for your individual patient. But it really is, it's very difficult. I mean, it really starts to wear you down. We have a high rate of burnout, especially among primary care physicians, last about 10 to 15 years in this country before they leave practice. Many physicians here have code words that they use in their charts now, so that they won't get their patients in trouble with their insurance companies, and which is, as you can imagine, that's very poor for communication between physicians. If I don't know what the other physician's code words are, how can I read that person's chart and understand it? So I think that one of the things I've been encouraging is for physicians to just start talking about, you know, what we'd like to see and what we're experiencing and how the two don't really go together. But despite this and despite the kind of negative press that a single-payer system gets here, the majority of physicians in this country actually do support and improve Medicare for All.
Well, therefore, why don't you, like we did with Physicians for Social Responsibility, we recruited 23,000 doctors by doing grand rounds all over the country and educating them about the medical effects of nuclear power and nuclear war. But surely there must be some way to bring all the physicians in America together in a potent force, I mean, through the AMA and the various colleges and the like, potent force to say, okay, look, yeah, I mean, this is, we wouldn't do this because it's unethical, but you could even think of going on strike and saying we're not treating anyone anymore until you have a free healthcare system. I mean, it's something really, really big and potent has to happen to change things, Margaret, to change the thinking. And we're a very powerful group of people, our profession, because let's face it, even every politician has to have his or her doctor, you know, so we can get to everybody.
That's exactly what Physicians for National Health Program has been doing now. They train physicians to speak about this and to give grand rounds, and also encouraging physicians to write letters to the editor and op-eds in the newspapers. And, you know, we've been doing that, and Physicians for National Health Program now has about 18,000 physicians that are active members. But it's not going to be sufficient. I mean, we have to recognize that our political system is completely broken. Members of Congress will tell people whatever they want to hear, but then they'll do whatever their corporate funders, you know, tell them to do. There's a group here called Progressive Democrats of America, and they got a number of these so-called progressive Democrats elected to Congress. Many of them ran on a single-payer platform, and once they got into Congress, they would not even talk about single-payer. The leadership from the White House and the leadership in Congress tells the members, you know, what they can say and what they can't say. They give them their talking points, and it's really crazy. It's the time that I spent in Congress. It's really a strange place. Most everybody is not telling the truth, and it's just full of games. And that's why I think we're going to have to do something bigger. We're going to have to build a broad movement and work to undermine the kind of pillars that hold our current system together by building these alternative systems that are outside of the corporate structure until we can weaken them to a point where they can be possibly effective.
Oh, boy. Well, what about, how many, 16,000 physicians, you said, who support?
18,000, right.
Well,
and we're working with the medical students, and the medical students are actually, they really get it.
They're really good. So what about, do you have all the emails of those 18,000 physicians?
Yes.
Well, what about encouraging them, inviting them, and getting them to come to the, you know, March 30th demonstration in DC? They can afford it. They can catch a plane. They can take a bus or drive a car and come and have just droves and droves and droves of doctors in white coats with their stethoscopes and mirrors on their heads. What about that?
Yeah, that would be wonderful. I don't think it would actually change the system. I had done a lot of that during 2009, 2010.
Yeah.
You know, during when health reform was you know, being debated, and I joined a group called the Mad as Hell Doctors. They formed in Oregon, and they traveled from Washington State on the west coast of the country all the way across the country to Washington D.C. And I traveled with them along the way, and then I came home to D.C. and organized a big rally for when they arrived in Washington. They had a big caravan that came in with signs and streamers, and we had a big rally right in front of the White House. People came from every state. Doctors came, white coats, and we held a big rally, and I had actually tried to get a number of the physicians to join me in handcuffing ourselves to the White House fence to demand, a national health program. And it was tough to get physicians who would be brave enough to do something like that. And there was this sense, you know, Obama he's very tricky. One of the people that I work with calls him the more effective evil. You know, in the United States, we always talk about how we have to vote for the lesser of two evils.
Mm.
Democrats, you know, think it would be awful if a Republican was elected, and the Republicans think it would be, you know, disastrous if a Democrat was elected president. And so people were really reluctant to criticize President Obama because they were really fooled by his rhetoric and you know, thought that he would be different. And he's gotten away with things that probably President Bush wouldn't have gotten away with because progressives would have been screaming instead of making excuses.
I agree. I'm interviewing Dr. Margaret Flowers, a pediatrician and co-director of It's Our Economy .us. Now, there was a bill before Congress years ago which the farmers didn't like at all, and hundreds of farmers converged on Washington with trucks full of pigs and sheep and cows, and they released them all over the congressional steps, and they made a hell of a mess, of course, it drew all the television stations there, and they were all over television. And in fact, that bill was not passed because the farmers got such publicity. I can imagine droves of doctors in white coats all walking up the congressional steps to occupy Congress. I mean, then the other thing I thought of, which is just sort of a crazy notion, but it was when we were talking about nuclear war, and we still should be talking about nuclear war, was a protest called BAP, Babies Against the Pentagon. And at some point during the Senate hearings, you release hundreds of naked toddlers into the Senate chamber.
Oh my goodness.
You could get in there because the children, you know, the children are benign and stuff, and just take off their diapers, napkins, and release them. And then I said, and the senators can clean up the mess. But, you know, because the babies are a symbol of what we're really talking about. They're the future, both of the political situation, the medical situation, and indeed the environmental situation on the planet.
Right.
I'm thinking of something sort of visually arresting, but something that really, really gets the television interested so they'll start covering it. And doctors are so potent if they can be properly orchestrated and organised, and if they will do what is necessary. I don't know. It's just a thought, Margaret.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, we did. We had one protest in December of 2009, just before the Senate passed its version of the health bill. And one of our senators actually introduced an amendment which would have substituted a single-payer health system for the bill that was being put together.
Mm.
And the leadership passed over it. They didn't allow that amendment to come to the floor. And it just happened to be around the time of the International Human Rights Day. So we held a large rally outside of the Senate, and we took black paper and made cutouts that looked like, you know, when there's a murder victim and they do a chalk outline of the body, we made what looked like big chalk outlines of dead bodies. And we wrote on each one the number of people that died in each state because they didn't have health insurance. And we went into the Senate offices and we put these bodies down on the floor and gave a letter to the senators, you know, explaining what was going on. And it actually worked that because of that, the leadership allowed that amendment to come to the floor. And it lasted all of 3 hours. It was actually a physician from Oklahoma, a Republican, who used a parliamentary maneuver to kill that amendment.
Really?
Really. It was just outrageous.
He should be deregistered and struck off the medical register, never be allowed to practice again.
I wish, you know, I wish it would work that way. We really don't have much of a rule of law left in this country.
I know. You're being so creative, Margaret. I really doff my cap. You're trying all sorts of wonderful things. I, you know, when I'm in Washington, I'm coming down specially from Philadelphia that day by train, and then flying off to Spokane, actually, that night, I think. To Portland to speak at the Physicians for Social Responsibility dinner. But if there's any way we could sort of put our heads together and strategize, so to speak, you know, I'd love to do that, but you're probably going to be too busy with all sorts of things happening that day.
Well, it's the first day of the month-long occupation, and it's very possible that we could do something. I need to look and see if I don't think that Congress is in session that day, but there may be something we can do to get some attention with, you know, two pediatricians in town. You know, perhaps we can figure something out.
Yeah, we need a couple of babies. I always find if I give a speech, you know, and I'm talking about nuclear war and the end of life on Earth and stuff, and people are a bit shocked, if I can find a baby in the audience, I get the baby and stand up on the stage and I say, this is what I've been talking about. This is the symbol.
Right.
And people lose it. They cry. There has to be a way to get into their guts, into their soul, into their emotions, because these people, particularly men, legislators are so good at blocking out their right brains and their midbrains and their emotions. Actually, they use their midbrains are where their emotions are engendered. Then they use their left brain to rationalize what their emotions want them to do, which is take more money so that they can get re-elected. But if you can crack it and get to where they really live and imagine their mother dying of cancer and not being able to afford, you know, the chemotherapy or the radiation or even just the nursing care in the richest country on earth, you know, if you can get to that level of their emotions, that'll often do it.
Well, perhaps we can have a press conference, because it's likely that there won't be a lot going on in Washington that day. So usually when that happens, we can get pretty good media coverage, because we really are talking about the future of human life. I mean, you well know the fact that we're using our planetary resources at, you know, 140% of capacity, and that's not sustainable. So we've really got to act quickly and turn things around.
I know. The thing is, we'd both agree with this, it's so important to get to the root cause of the problem, of the etiology of the problem, etiology meaning the cause of a disease, and the fact that the planet is in the intensive care unit now, and it's critically ill, whether it's terminal or not, I don't know. And I always say we are now all physicians to a dying planet, all of us. And as we read Grey's Anatomy to learn to become physicians, and we're very highly trained and educated, so people must become well-educated, as Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And then have the sort of dedication and commitment that we have at 3 a.m. when we're on duty and the patient in the intensive care unit is not doing well. And we might hit the wall at 3, you know, and just think we're just going to die of exhaustion, but then we'll have, you know, a milkshake or something and a hamburger and buck ourselves up and go on. And we never really think of ourselves, do we, in those situations? We only think of our patients, Margaret.
Right, right. And that's exactly what we need to be doing. And one of the taglines for the occupation that we had in Washington, D.C. on our website was human need, not corporate greed. And what we told people is that we need to stop looking to our leaders to solve our problems. We need to start coming together in our communities and solving the problems ourselves. And that will actually, in itself, will start to shift the power away from this 1%, you know, corporate stranglehold on our political process to the people, as we create sustainable food networks and, you know, insist on public transportation and create democratized economies, local, you know, local living economies. These are all things that we can do.
Well, the other thing we can do, and people don't do it nearly enough. Number one, voting in Australia is compulsory, Margaret. We get fined if we don't vote. I think about $50. Number two, registration is just automatic because we're registered where we live to vote. Number three, I say to people in America, you don't have a right to live in a democracy if you don't vote. Why don't you go and live in Libya or something? And number four, people on the whole don't know who their representatives are. And what they should do is every 2 weeks, when those representatives come home to their home district, they need to make appointments and go and see them and make friends with them and educate them. Because if you don't say, look, we're your constituents and we want this, this and this from you, and educate them, give them stuff to read, make sure that they're educated, then the democracy is not going to function, because a vacuum is left, a total vacuum into which step the corporations. And as we know that these representatives are not our leaders, we are their leaders. And if we don't take that action to educate them per se directly, then we'll get nowhere. I mean, we can do all the other things too, which you're suggesting, but I really do strongly suggest that be part of the Occupy movement's agenda.
Well, we're actually, you know, we're encouraging the group of us who organized the Occupation of Freedom Plaza are encouraging people to take kind of a long-term view, because we don't think at this point that, because the way the system works, that electing people into the system is going to change things until we build a big enough movement that can hold the whoever's in the system accountable. Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, said that he never endorsed a candidate. He said he wanted to be not the master or servant of either party, but the one that, you know, held them accountable. And that's really where we're putting our energies right now into building the movement, educating people about things that they can do locally in their communities to both grow the community and grow the movement, and to create, you know, democratized institutions. We can have an effect at the local level in this country. But in the long view, you know, at some point, legislative and electoral strategies will be more effective. But our thinking is this year, you know, the conversation that's going to be held amongst the candidates is a false conversation. It's restricted by what their corporate funders allow them to speak about. And the real conversation is the one that we're encouraging people to have in their local communities about what the real issues are, yeah, and the ways to solve those issues.
Well,
it's challenging. We're having kind of the real opposite of democracy in this country, as we're seeing more obstacles to people being able to vote, to being able to register to vote, or to even be able to vote on election day. We see practices in this country where, particularly in minority communities, where the, you know, election groups will actually put posters up in neighborhoods saying the wrong date to vote, or they'll put notices up saying that if you have any sort of an unpaid bill or an outstanding ticket, that you aren't allowed to vote. There's a real undermining of democracy in this country.
Well, Dr. Margaret Flowers, maybe you're going to be the next Dr. Martin Luther King. What about that?
Well, I think that that there's going to be a lot of next Dr. Martin Luther Kings. I think that we need to start looking to ourselves as leaders,
yes,
and realizing that we do have the wisdom to start addressing the problems that we face.
The wisdom, the strength, the passion, the courage, we do. Anyway, Margaret, it's been a wonderful interview. Thank you so much. We're out of time now, and I do look forward to seeing you very much on March the 30th, and just the very best of luck for everything you're doing.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real honor and a pleasure to speak with you today, and I do look forward to meeting you on March 30th in D.C.
Thank you, Margaret.
Bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dr. Margaret Flowers, a pediatrician and co-director of itsoureconomy.us. I think it was a very interesting and important interview. I think we all have to start looking inwards now and working out what we are going to do to save our planet. And I do really mean with passion, integrity, courage, and honour. We've all got that inside us. We've all got different and wonderful talents, different from everyone else. If we use them, we can do it. Thanks for listening today, and we'll be back next time with you for another great program. If you want to contribute to our program, please go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.